I'm now really excited to introduce the next group of speakers who will be sharing their expertise around what we can all learn from disability justice movements. From incredible online campaigning to advocating for access and building the power of those at the intersections, the disability justice movement is one I think that we can all learn from. And on a personal note, I would really like to thank these campaigners from the bottom of my heart who have embraced, taught, and listened to me since becoming a disabled person a couple of years ago. I don't think I have ever felt a community of activists who were so encouraging and so embracing. The Australian Progress team would also like me to pass on their sincere thanks for the feedback they've received from disability justice advocates since Progress 2019. Our movements are stronger when we work together, so it's essential that accessibility and inclusivity are standard practice across our work. I am very excited for this session, so please join me in anticipation and share your excitement in the chat. Leading the conversation today will be Kerra Sherwood O'Regan. Kerra is an Indigenous and disabled multidisciplinary storyteller and rights advocate. Based in Aotearoa, New Zealand, she is the co-founder and communications and impact director at Activate, an Indigenous and disabled social impact agency specializing in campaigning and narratives for social change. I'm going to hand over to Kerra to introduce herself, and then she is going to introduce each of our guest speakers in turn. So I will leave you in Kerra's very capable hands.
Oh, tēnā koe, ngā mihi, mōtera, Jamila, thank you so much. Tēnā koutou katoa, nō mai haere mai ki tēnei kōrero ki te kaupapa o ngā tika tangata, o te mana o te hapori whaikaha, ko Kerra Sherwood O'Regan tōku ikua, nō te waipounamu te iwi kaitahu ahau. So kia ora everyone, and welcome to this session on disability justice with two very wonderful speakers for us to all learn from and who I'm very eager to introduce shortly. As I was introduced, my name's Kerra. I'm a proudly disabled wahine from the Kaitahu Iwi or tribe of Te Waipounamu, which is the South Island of Aotearoa, New Zealand. And I'm currently speaking to you all from Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland, where I live and work on Ngāti Pāua Whenua, so Ngāti Pāua land. And I'm very, very privileged to be able to be here. I think I'd also really like to mihi to our Indigenous whanaunga in Ahitereria, where most attendees are joining from, and to just really acknowledge the deep expertise that First Peoples hold, I think across the board, but particularly about their whenua, their lands, their communities, and about inclusive social movements, which I think is the kaupapa or the reason that we're all here today. I think for me, I've been organising in the climate and social justice movement for about 15 years. And one of the things that I've been really excited to be involved in more recently has been around, you know, developing my own understanding of disability rights and disability justice, which is a framework that was developed by SINS Invalid. And I'd really encourage everyone to check out their mahi, to check out their work around how these issues of disability justice and disability rights intersect within our climate movement, within social justice issues, and everything that really makes up our progressive movement. And so I'm very excited and very glad that Progress has taken on board a lot of feedback from our disabled community to be able to hold this space for these kōrero, for these discussions, because I think it is really essential to recognise that our progressive movement does have an ableism problem. Our progressive movement has an ableism problem. Our progressive movement has a whiteness problem. And I think that it's essential that if we want to tackle these intersecting problems, that we take the lead from disabled people of colour. And I think that first starts with acknowledging that, you know, our movement and some of our own activism, including my own, has caused harm. You know, we have to acknowledge that we've caused harm. And that can be a really deeply uncomfortable thing to recognise and to work through. And so I want to acknowledge Progress for having having taken that feedback on board. And I want to encourage everyone who's joining here to really sit with any discomfort that does come up, because I think that shows that we're learning. It shows that we're recognizing the injustices that have gone on within our progressive movement for decades. And I think it's really exciting that we're in this space where we now are able to learn from each other, where disabled people are finally having a platform to share the expertise that exists within our communities. And so I think on that note, I'm very, very privileged to be able to introduce some leaders in this space that we all have an opportunity to learn from. And so for me as a disabled person who's, you know, been continuously on that journey of unpacking my own internalized ableism as well as racism, I think finding communities online has been really essential in my learning and for my well-being. And over Twitter, one person that I've learned a lot from has been Imani Barbarin. So I'm very, very excited to meet you in person or over the screen, but still having a little bit of a fangirl moment here. But Imani is an incredible disability rights and inclusion activist and speaker who continuously uses her voice and platforms to create conversations that really engage our whole disability community. And so, born with cerebral palsy, Imani often writes and uses her platform to speak from the perspective of a disabled Black woman. And in the past few years has created so many different hashtags that have been really crucial and I think essential for our community to come together and to be able to share our perspectives and have our voices heard while also forcing the world to take notice. And some of those are things like the hashtag patients are not faking, things disabled people know and ableds are weird, which I've used a lot, and others that provide a window into disabled life while forming community. So know my Imani, it's such an amazing opportunity to have you here. And the second person I'd really like to introduce as well is Damien Griffiths. So Damien is a descendant of the Wurundjeri people, and he's a leading advocate for the human rights of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people with disability. And he's been a central figure in the establishment of both the Aboriginal Disability Network in New South Wales and the national organising organising and representing the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people with disabilities and their families through the First Peoples Disability Network Australia, the FPDN. So he's joining us on screen now. Know my Damien, welcome. So great to have you on here. And in 2014, he also won the Tony Fitzgerald Memorial Award at the Australian Human Rights Awards. And Damien, I've been really, really stoked to be following you on Twitter for a wee while now as well and learning a lot from you. So Nomai, welcome to you both. And I'll pass over to Imani to start your korero.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. It's very lovely to meet you, Kara. Given the current moment that we're living in, I'm going to resist the urge to say something along the lines of disability justice has never been more important than this moment. To be honest, the disability justice has always been important. We're just now noticing it. COVID-19 has really opened up all of society's ills. No matter where you live, we're looking at the ways in which people are marginalized and who's given power to succeed, even when crises strike. I started my blog in 2014, Crutches and Spice, as a way to really kind of see myself as a disabled Black person. At the time, I didn't see it at all. I'd grown up in the suburbs of Philadelphia, hoping that somebody would look like me on TV. I used to write scripts or write myself into TV shows, thinking that I could be there one day, and representation has been lagging. But I really wanted to create the representation that I had so often desired growing up. And disability discrimination and racism starts from a very young age for Black disabled people. When I was born, I was limp. I couldn't move. I couldn't lift my head up. I couldn't move my legs. And my mother went around from doctor to doctor for 2 years as a Black woman, and nobody believed her. She asked doctors, she asked nurses, she was asking everybody she could think of to say, my daughter needs a diagnosis, she needs services, she needs surgeries. Why can't I get them? Why can't I get what I need? And it has really been through a network of Black women that got me a diagnosis and got me the services that I needed growing up. But the way that our society works is that if you want services as a Black disabled person, you're going to be going through schools that are in white, predominantly white areas. So when I was in elementary school or primary school, I was bused to a school that was not in my district. My district was more Black and brown people. I was bused to a school district that was mostly white and stayed in mostly white schools for much of my life because they had better outcomes for me than the special education at Black and brown schools. And that separated me from my race in so many ways. Growing up, I was told I talk white or that I was interested in things that my Black peers were not interested in because I went to school during the week as a Black person in a predominantly white area, and I went to church on the weekends as one of the only disabled people in my church, or at the very least, visibly disabled person in my church. So I was really stuck between these two worlds that told me that I had to choose which identity I was to be facing them with at any given time. And I no longer wanted to live in that life and say to myself, you have to separate out what people want and don't want from you in any given moment. And so when I started using Twitter and blogging, it was, to be honest, it was mostly to get more people than my mom to read my blog because she had stopped reading it. But it was also to make sure that I could build community with other people that looked like me. And the internet has truly provided that for me. And I started using hashtags like CryptoVote and Disability2White. CryptoVote was created by Alice Wong, Greg Baratan, Andrew Pulmering, and Disability2White was created by Vilissa Thompson. And it showed me an entire community that I had missed out on my entire life. I was taught to normalize my disability. I was taught that it was not marketable for me as somebody who wanted to be employed, to talk about it, to be open about it, specifically as a Black disabled woman. I had been raised to say that I am a Black woman first, not a Black disabled person. So seeing a community of disabled people that were excited about who they were and were not making any apologies about it, that really is what radicalized me to be the person that I am today. And I am forever thankful and grateful for it. As you currently know, we are going through a very tumultuous time, especially as it pertains to racial dynamics, socioeconomic dynamics, as well as disability. The disability community has been particularly hit hard by COVID-19. People in nursing homes are dying in droves in the United States, and around the country. And so that deeply impacts our disability community, who's been working hard for the last few decades to move away from institutional settings and congregate care settings into individualized homes and community-based services. And so when we think of the experiences that we're seeing play out on a national scale, they are no longer as hidden as they were. We're seeing people report on nursing home deaths and institutional deaths, and we really can no longer ignore it. These experiences are systemic. The ways that racial dynamics are segregated to weed out the oppressed are very much so in our forefront. As Black disabled people, we are policed disproportionately from the time we are in school. Black and brown kids are usually lack a diagnosis, like my story earlier, early on in their childhood development. So that means that when they are in school, they're diagnosed with behavior problems, they're seen as problems in the classrooms. And as Americans specifically, we have police in our classrooms that are ready to arrest children and feed them into the school to prison pipeline. 30 to 40% of people in America in jails and prisons have a disability. And that is a huge problem that nobody is willing to talk about. And not only that, but in the Black Lives Matter moment that we are currently in, disabled Black people are in a very precarious situation. We are not only erased by society as disabled people as a whole, we are also victims of racism, classism, And even from within our own racial community, even from Black people, our disabilities are erased as a part of the greater good. History has taught us that claiming disability as Black people is risky and dangerous. From slavery, Black disabled slaves were either fed to alligators, they were their rations were diminished so much that they would starve to death, or if they were very, very lucky, they were stolen by their mothers and taken to circuses and freak shows to live with those performers and to tour the country. So we have been ostracized, we have been separated out from our communities for a very long time, and we can no longer afford to ignore disability and race and how it impacts people. And I kind of want to give you a kind of a little bit of an overview as to how ableism and disability justice frameworks inform your work. Ableism does not exist on its own. It is also a function of racism, classism, queer phobia, transphobia, and many other bigotries. When we think about how we are going to other groups in society, people often turn to disability and diagnoses. And you can see this particularly in the progressive space right now. If you notice, if you are on Twitter, if you're on Instagram, you are watching progressive platforms make fun of Donald Trump's disability as a way to other him as somebody who's unqualified for his job. Now, he is unqualified for his job for many more reasons than that. But the message that it sends is that disabled people are not qualified to be in leadership positions. Disabled people are consistently told that we are capable of anything, that we can do anything that we want. But as soon as that impacts somebody else's life, as soon as that means that we are in leadership roles, people start to question our ability and capacity to do those things. So when we think about isms, when we think about bigotry, when we think about discrimination, we have to look at just how tied together to those institutions ableism is. And one of the things I would like people to really start to comprehend and dissect is the concept of capacity. A lot of people are told in the disability community they do not have the capacity to work or to contribute or to make a difference in society in little ways. Because while we rely on inspiration porn to make us feel better about disability in society, what the message is that unless you are valued in a way in which you don't impact my life, then I don't want to see it. Disability means that you have to evaluate your own capacity and say what you want to do. Everybody can contribute in their own way. And the internet has given disabled people a tool in which to contribute to these moments in time. In the 60s, the disability rights movement used their wheelchairs to block buses to protest discriminatory transportation practices. Now we have hashtags, we have deep conversations on politics. We call out our politicians online. They know my @ on Twitter. And so disabled people have been organizing, but we really have to get away from this idea of capacity and denigrating disabled people's contributions to movements as slacktivism because we can't go out into the street, particularly during this pandemic. So I want you to get away from that concept. I also want to get you away from the concept of intelligence. Intelligence is a very ableist concept, and we use it particularly against Black and Brown people. We use education as a carrot towards progress and inclusion into greater opportunities, but then we denigrate people who do not have access as less intelligent, when in reality, they just don't have as many opportunities as others. And those opportunities are given to the top and given to the privilege to succeed. So evaluate what your ideas of intelligence and capacity are in whatever movement you are building with or with different people. So I want to talk a little bit away. I want to go a little bit backwards and talk about the ways in which ableism informs other forms of bigotry and how society sees them. So if we examine all these bigotries, we see the ways that ableism further marginalize these groups. So the poor are often blamed for their poverty and told that they are too unintelligent to understand their own finances. People of color are told that their health outcomes are due to the inability to control their emotions and urges when it comes to food and nutrition. Women are considered too emotional in leadership positions. Queer and trans people are told their lifestyles are due to mental illnesses and are dangerously forced into conversion therapies and that are widely considered torture. So these are all the ways in which ableism is codified in the way that we interact with different marginalized groups. And a lot of times in these other marginalized groups, disabled people are even further marginalized within these categories. So it's really important that we take a holistic look at the ways in which ableism informs our talking points, informs the way we interact with one another, and informs the way we consider multidimensional justice. While for the marginalized, ableism is a way to denigrate others, for white supremacy, it is a way to excuse their actions. So for times when America deals with a lot of mass violence, particularly at the hands of white supremacists and neo-Nazis, and that's what they are, and that's what I will call them. And so for them, ableism is a way to separate out those actions as individual rather than systemic. Many people think of it diagnosis as an individual problem. And that is what we're seeing with the COVID-19 response. That is an individual problem to be dealt with individual strategies, when we need community-based strategies. But anyways, white supremacy uses ableism to say that these people are mentally ill, they don't know what they're doing, to distract from the fact that it's a systemic issue that allows this violence to take place. And so it's basically playing a sleight of hand using disability to tell society that racism has nothing to do with the systems and institutions that society has built, but everything to do with one person, their choices, and their own diagnosis. What's devastating about this moment in history, both from the perspective of racial justice and the pandemic, is that above everybody else I've met, disabled people were the most prepared to meet this moment. While a lot of non-disabled people were able to coordinate remote working, remote organizing, disabled people had been doing that for years. And so we build community care online. So when we think about organizing, disabled people have been doing all of this community care ourselves from the get-go. And so what I encourage you to do is to follow disabled people in their own spaces, like Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We have been building these platforms forever. And so I think my time is up. I greatly appreciate it. I will answer any questions you have. Thank you all for having me. I am glad to be in your homes. I hope you all are staying safe.
Hello. Good morning, everyone. Thank you to the organizers for the opportunity today. I'd like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners on whose land we're on today around the country. I'm speaking to you on Darug country in northwest Sydney. I'd also like to acknowledge elders past, present, and emerging, and also take the opportunity to pay special respect to two of our founding elders, Uncle Lester Bostock, a pioneer of Aboriginal media and also the disability rights movement, and a proud Bundjalung man, and also Uncle Aunty and Aunty Gail, who a proud Ngunnawal woman who we lost recently. I'd like to make special mention of those two leaders. So I think I've got about 10 minutes to speak, so that's a brief amount of time. There's a lot of things to try and cover, but I thought I'd begin by telling you a bit about the First Peoples Disability Network. So we're a national organisation representing Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people with disability and their families, a very unique organisation here in Australia in that we are owned and operated by Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people with disability themselves. So our board is made up of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people that have a range of different disabilities. Our board members include Aboriginal people with physical disability, intellectual disability, acquired brain injury, blind and deaf also. And also our staff, we're a small secretariat, and every one of our staff members either has disability themselves or a very close personal association with disability. So in a lot of ways, we're a consumer-based organisation representing the voices of our own people with Indigenous people with disability. So in thinking about the topic today and a range of different issues that are happening in the world at the moment, I was reflecting on what is justice exactly for Aboriginal people with disability. So justice includes the right to live free from poverty. Many Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people with disability here in Australia live in often very extreme poverty. It's the right to an opportunity for employment, the right to an education. Too many of our young Aboriginal people with disability don't get the opportunity to complete an education because of the lack of resources that may be available to them in the communities in which they live. It's the right to be free from discrimination. And like Imani was talking about, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people with disability face what's referred to as intersectional discrimination. So discrimination based on their indigeneity and or disability. And that presents us an extra barrier, if you like, a double disadvantage, or if you perhaps add gender or other aspects, it may be a triple disadvantage in many ways. But when it comes to interactions with the actual justice system itself, we at the First Peoples Disability Network are growing increasingly concerned about the growing criminalisation of disability here in Australia. And much like Imani was talking about before, there are very high rates of disability in the Aboriginal prison population across the country. And there are deeply concerning issues around the prevalence of disability amongst Aboriginal deaths in custody, for example. The Guardian newspaper reported that 42.8% of Aboriginal deaths in custody are of Aboriginal people with disability. And we often see this increasing criminalisation because of the intersection between racism and ableism. And it plays out particularly for Aboriginal people that experience psychosocial disability or mental illness. We often say in the First Peoples Disability Network that if you're going to have a psychotic episode, you better make it on the third Tuesday of every fourth month when the mental health team's in town, or you end up in the back of a paddy wagon, frankly, and that's exactly what happens. And then you may appear before a magistrate who perhaps doesn't have a great understanding of disability or may have some preconceived ideas, and you may end up, in fact, in prison. Another issue that's of very grave concern and an extraordinary violation of human rights here in Australia is the indefinite detention of Aboriginal people with disability in Australian prisons. It happens particularly in the Northern Territory and Western Australia, but not unique to those jurisdictions. So that results when a situation where an Aboriginal person with disability may be considered a danger to themselves or a danger to others, and they're effectively accommodated in jail. And invariably, they end up in jail for much longer periods of time than perhaps if they'd pled guilty to a particular crime. And sometimes Aboriginal people with disability end up indefinitely detained for what are effectively very minor crimes. And again, this is a failure of the disability service system to provide meaningful support, but it's also about the deliberate and active attempt to remove people with disability, particularly Aboriginal people with disability, from society. What we're starting to analyse further at the First Peoples Disability Network, and again goes to a bit of the issues that Imani touched on, is at the point of invasion, when the English came, they brought with them a worldview of disability that was different to the Indigenous view of disability. And essentially that was about locking people up. It wasn't long before Sydney was being created or developed that very quickly there were institutions built. Within a matter of years, there was schools for orphans and a number of Aboriginal young people were placed in those schools. Or there were very unfortunate terms like idiot houses created, or institutions cropped up very quickly. And they still dot the landscape today here in Sydney and, in fact, hold some of the most prime pieces of real estate. And they're usually sandstone buildings that sit either on top of hills or next to rivers. And that was about removing people from society. That is in complete conflict with the Indigenous view on disability, which I'll explain briefly to you in a minute. So when it comes to these issues of indefinite detention, the overrepresentation of Aboriginal people with disability in Australian prisons, we've taken these issues to the United Nations on a number of occasions. And Australia, frankly, stands condemned in relation to these issues. We've taken these matters before the UN Committee on the Rights of Persons with Disability. We've taken it also to the UN Committee Against Torture and Inhumane Treatment. And on every occasion, the UN has been damning, frankly, of Australia's performance with this in this regard. What is extraordinary and deeply frustrating for all of us at FPDN and a lot of disability activists in this space is there's really been no activity taken by any government really of any great note around the country other than some discussions around law reform, which is clearly needed. There's no doubt there is a technical aspect to it. But actually the deeper issue is why these things happen. Why as a society there's these active practices which mean the removal of people, often people that shouldn't be in that situation in the first place. So I guess what I was anxious to also inform people of today, that it's really important to note that in traditional language, there is no comparable word for disability. So this is a wonderful thing, in that in Indigenous Australia, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people historically were not labelled. It's more come as you are. And this is a wonderful thing. And disability tends to be talked about appropriately in an impairment-based way. So brother there doesn't hear too well. Cousin's a bit slower than everyone else. Uncle has a bit of trouble moving around. Not said in a pejorative way, but said in such a way that we need to recognise we need to provide particular supports perhaps for that person with disability in our community to participate. This is a profound but simple in many ways thing to understand. Like I said before, when the Western approach, when the invaders came, they brought with them their worldview, which is inherently about either locking people with disability away, or people with disability were often subjects or of ridicule or objects of charity perhaps. We know this is profound because there has been a recent discovery at the very significant archaeological site in New South Wales, Lake Mungo, where there's been the discovery of a single footprint, and it appears there's a stick. And the footprint has been dated at least 25,000 years old. So that is a footprint of a male, an Aboriginal male with one leg, who was participating in community life. So there's always been roles and always been ways to support and value the roles of people with disability in Indigenous Australia. So I guess I wanted to finish with the, perhaps it's a plea in a way, in recognition that in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Australia, we are the thought leaders on inclusion. We have always practiced inclusion. Inclusion is innate in Aboriginal Australia. There's no doubt there are issues, and there's no doubt there are situations where our own people with disability face particular challenges. And there is a real challenge in having the voices of First Peoples disability heard within the wider First Peoples movement because of a number of conflicting priorities. So I don't want to romanticise it, but the reality is that we need the system to adjust its thinking to recognise that we are the thought leaders on inclusion. We've always had ways of supporting our community members with disability, and the system needs to change its thinking. like so many things in the world at the moment, it seems things are basically upside down. And I guess the only other thing I'd finish on is that well-known international disability rights mantra of nothing about us without us, that very simple proposition that a person with disability themselves knows what's best for themselves. Thank you.
Oh, mihalo. Fantastic. Thank you so much, both Damien and Imani, for your really important kōrero, your really important discussions. I think, I can say for myself that I've learned a lot from this, but also I'm sure this is something that our audience, however many people are watching, I can't see how many people are watching, but I'm sure there are many people in the audience who have learned a huge amount from both of your discussions. And so moving into the Q&A, we have a few, about 10 minutes for this. And I was just reflecting on the discussion, you know, from you, Imani, as well as Damien, around that prison pipeline. So, you know, we've heard that there is a massive issue in the way that the police force and this pipeline is set up that targets, you know, Black disabled people in the United States. Obviously, you've also raised, Damien, that that's an issue for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in Australia. And I think when I was hearing from both of you, that felt quite deep for me, because I know that that's a massive issue in Aotearoa as well, where we have a lot of people who think we're a very, very progressive country and we don't have any violence and that sort of thing. And we are very fortunate in some ways, but we do also know that a huge portion of our prison population is made up of Indigenous and disabled folk. And we do know that particularly our Indigenous and disabled men experience a huge amount of violence from the police. And so I was just reflecting on this, you know, I guess a similar but different shared kind of experience between our different countries. And I'm wondering if we could talk a little bit about, you know, whether you think there are similarities between this pipeline to prisons and the institutionalization of, you know, disabled people, people with disabilities across each of our countries. I know we have quite different contexts, but I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about that, around how our people, you know, have been institutionalized within medical, mental health, education systems, and, you know, a specific disability institutional system. And whether you think that that is connected, and perhaps what we could do about that.
Yeah, so in the United States, we have been slowly closing our institutions since about the 70s. Right as we were starting to close institutions, was about the same time that they started ramping up, you know, broken windows policing and all of these very, very tough police practices. And they really gave no training to police on how to interact with disabled people who were now re-entering the communities en masse. And there were also no services at the time. You know, the Americans with Disabilities Act didn't pass until 1990 in the United States. You know, there were been the 504 sit-ins and the Rehabilitation Act in the United States around the 60s and 70s. But a lot of people did not either know about it. It wasn't in a lot of places, it wasn't even enforced. And so you have a perfect storm whereby people are in the community, they're interacting, particularly Black and Brown people, and their actions are criminalized because it is deemed dangerous. And so either you go into one or two pipelines, which is prison or an institution. And while, even though we were still closing them, we were still, sometimes we were calling it by a different name. We have set up ways for, you know, young Black and Brown people to think that they're graduating high school and they don't. And so they don't have as many job opportunities. And so other things happen. But yeah, you know, it is very, very similar. I feel like there's very narrow idea of where you're supposed to go if you're a disabled person of color in this country.
Yeah, I might add my two Bosworth there. It is like Imani said, from one institution to another, effectively. So at the First Peoples with Disability Network, we talk about the life trajectory. And again, I think Imani touched on this in her speech. So we often, what we see is a scenario, say, where a young Aboriginal kid with disability in the classroom may be acting up, may be frustrated, may actually, in fact, have undiagnosed disability, likely to be a hearing impairment, perhaps vision issues, or perhaps comes from an environment where the young person may be not getting enough sleep, for example, but the child is quickly labelled as a bad black kid. So we call it the bad black kid syndrome. And I'm talking in generalisations here, but it is an institutional racism and institutional ableism issue, I would argue. So, and then the child will be removed from school, suspended, expelled, even at primary school age. Then that young Aboriginal child may be hanging around the local shop, say, and then starts to get told to move on by the local police. And then they're on this trajectory into juvenile justice where their disability needs are not met in any meaningful way. They're a prisoner. And then from there into adult prison. There's a clear opportunity for pivot points in that young person's life where supports are required, including providing additional support to the family, for example. They may need some understanding of how to provide mental support. That's possible too. But there's always opportunities along the way to intervene, if you like, to avoid this life trajectory. This is a chronic problem across Australia. You're not unique to Australia, I understand, to be similar in New Zealand and certainly in the US. But this other thing of othering people or the non-worthiness of Aboriginal people with disability because they're black and disabled, you know, they're not making a contribution to society, so we don't really care, and we can kind of get away with this, actually, of locking people away. That's sometimes the way the system, we believe, would approach it. There's some fundamental failings here too, though. There's a lack of culturally appropriate mental health supports. They virtually don't exist in regional remote Australia, and many mental health advocates can speak to that better than I can. But there's some huge failings along the way here. But in the end, we're talking about racism and ableism and the very serious, the devaluing of people, frankly. And that is something that society is going backwards here in Australia, we would argue. We can see a return to segregated education on the horizon. So we're going backwards in many ways. And the only other thing I would say is all this disadvantage is an industry. And it's an industry not owned by Aboriginal people. There's a number of vested interests that keep Aboriginal people with disability in prisons. And the more we go down the private prison path, well, logically, private prisons need prisoners, don't they? So that's their clientele. So then you create stricter, easier ways to get into prison, to be frank. So, yeah.
Ngā mihi kōrua, mō tēnei kōrua. Thank you both for your answers to that. I think personally, I feel like I could have this discussion with you both all day, and I would really, really like to, but I'm very conscious that we don't have a lot of time. So I did want to connect to one other question, which I think contributes or connects with what you just mentioned, Damien, around, these pipelines and institutionalization ultimately come down to this idea that disabled people, and particularly black and brown disabled people, are not contributing to society. And we use this idea of not contributing to society as a justification for all sorts of terrible abuses, whether that's, in the prison system, whether that's institutionalization and segregating people, whether that's, dismissing their mahi, their work and their contributions that they do make. And I just wanted to connect that up to what you were mentioning earlier in your corridor, in your speech, Imani, around this idea of selectivism, because I know for me as an activist, when I was growing up, that was a really big term that was thrown around a lot, and that is still often used to, I think, devalue the contributions that our disabled community do make and the activism and the work that we do. And I feel like that is so tied up with the kind of toxic productivity culture that seems to be ingrained in a lot of spaces and in a lot of workplaces, but also I've been seeing that become more and more ingrained and embedded within some progressive movements and within some activism. And I guess my kind of question around that is, what can we do about it? How do we dismantle that? you know, perhaps very briefly from both of you, you know, is this something that you've recognized in your work? And do you have any facado on how, any ideas on how we can start to eliminate that and make sure that our activism spaces are inclusive and accessible for our disabled community? So maybe I'll go reverse this time and go to Damien first and then come back to Imani, if that's all right.
Yeah. Sure. We would say, so I guess I'll use the example of the wider Indigenous rights movement or First Nations, First Peoples movement in Australia. At the First Peoples Disability Network, we're quite critical, to be honest, and we have to be. The reality is that, and we are keen supporters of the Uluru Statement, so I don't want to make any false assertions there, but the reality is that our people with disability didn't get to participate in that. There may have been one or two isolated incidences where people did, but it wasn't accessible. And even the Closing the Gap framework, which for people from overseas is a really important sort of systemic framework for addressing Indigenous disadvantage in Australia. Bizarrely, despite our advocacy for more than a decade, disability is not a target area. So again, this goes to the ability of the system to kind of ignore those most in need. We say at FPDN it's difficult to think of any more disadvantaged Australians than First Peoples with disability because of the intersectional discrimination, and that ability for the system to ignore it, frankly, it's not necessarily because the activism is not effective. It's just that complete devaluing of people with disability, and particularly when you add in another dimension of indigeneity. So what we need to do at what we like to do at FPN, and I'll finish up here and be brief because I know we don't have a lot of time, but we need friends. We need supporters. And we need other non-disabled people, for that matter, to understand the lived experience of First Peoples with disability. We need other champions to raise the voice and be a part of the voice, not take over the voice, but be partners, because many voices can make a change here. That's probably what I'd suggest, yeah.
Okay, sorry. I didn't, thank you, Damien, for your answer. When it comes to organizing, and especially organizing in digital spaces, what I find interesting is that we still use the language of capitalism to talk about anti-capitalist subject matter. And if we're using capitalism to evaluate disabled people, we're never going to measure up in the ways that people think we are. You know, even in the United States, you know, disabled people are allowed to be paid below the minimum wage, and we kind of use that as exact same rationing language to who gets seen and who gets heard from in a lot of movements. When it coming off of what Damien said is, you know, a lot of disabled people are not asked about our opinions for anything. And rather than thinking about disabled people on the back end, you have to think about us first. We need to be built into the systems, built into the questions you're asking politicians and leaders.
Very unfortunately, Imani's audio actually cut out, and the last few minutes of this event were not recorded. But I can read them for you now. Rather than thinking about disabled people on the back end, you have to think about us first. Means we need to be built into the system, built into the questions we are asking politicians and leaders. We need to be there from the beginning, not as an afterthought, or a side piece, I guess, just looking pretty on the sidelines. We need to be there from the beginning. A lot of times the idea of slacktivism is that less impactful if we are just online. But if we think about movements like the Black Lives Matter movement, if we think about us tagging politicians, we have gotten things done from our cell phones. So there is no slacktivism anymore. It's just a different way of doing things. And make everything you do accessible to disabled people. Have translators, have ramps in buildings, make sure your materials are in plain language at primary school, reading level, for those whose first language isn't English, or for those who are developmentally or intellectually disabled, or considered in those categories, and make sure everybody is involved. I think that we have to get away from a capitalist framework to express work that is inherently anti-capitalist, to make sure we include those narratives in what we are talking about from the beginning. We like to say, nothing about us without us. Don't think about us as an afterthought. We We are not here for a decoration. We have something to say. Thank you so much for joining us. Stay tuned for more Imagining Disability Justice. Next up, The Last Disabled Oracle.